Started it.
Still blessed.
Just ate up 40 minutes.
Yes.
Yes.
Good friends.
Yes.
We can call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this.
Me too.
Informational meeting on a report that was done by RAND and HMA analyzing four financial models for the delivery of health care in Oregon. And we have Representative Barbara Smith is going to introduce the hearing, and then we'll have some more folks come up after that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this opportunity to kind of set you a little bit of a stage before the RAND presentation. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner. I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Today, you will be hearing from the Oregon Health Authority, the RAND Corporation, and Health Management Associates on the comprehensive assessment of four options for financing healthcare delivery in Oregon, study and report. This analysis has been a long time coming. During the 2013 session, Senator Dembro, then the representative in my seat, was the chief sponsor of House Bill 3260, which commissioned a third-party study that would recommend the best options for financing health care in Oregon. No money was directly allocated to the study, so in 2015, House Bill 2828 extended the sunset on the report and appropriated $300,000 to the Oregon Health Authority for the purpose of actually hiring a third-party contractor for the study. Having been appointed to Senator Dembro's seat in the House before the start of the 2014 session, I assumed many of the bills that he had worked on during the previous session, including this one, and was proud to help get House Bill 2828 fully through the process so that we could have the study actually implemented. As a firm believer that healthcare is a human right, continuing work on a study examining single payer, the public option, the healthcare ingenuity plan, and our current status quo under the Affordable Care Act was something I gladly took on. So I worked alongside, Senator Dembro and OHA in the interim to make sure that the study fit the legislative intent of the original bill. I need to just really compliment profusely the folks that were involved, both from RAND and OHA, and the local partners with RAND, Health Management Associates, just some extremely knowledgeable, competent researchers and analysts. I just, the level of experience individually and combined that they brought to this effort was very impressive. The lead from RAND was very involved in the original Affordable Care Act. We had many great discussions. My work on healthcare reform goes back to 1994 when I helped to do some of the Health Security Express bus tours around the country when then President Clinton was attempting to do some significant healthcare reform. So I have been thrilled to continue that work going forward, and I was pleased with really the level of quality that we got in this report. Now, I don't think the study or the report are perfect necessarily, because if it was, it would have come out and said, "Why, yes, let's just." Because if it had agreed with what I wanted it to end up with, it would have said, let's go to single payer right now because it's the most efficient in everything way. That doesn't make it not perfect that it doesn't say that. But I think it's got a really lot of helpful data and insight. I do believe that some of the administrative cost savings and the coordination with pre-existing public infrastructure could have been further examined and taken into account during some of the analysis. But I got to tell you, given the, as you, this committee knows better than anyone, given the uncertainty of the healthcare status quo at the federal level, I think this study is just the beginning of the conversation on the future of healthcare here in Oregon. I look forward to being a part of the discussion with all of you, healthcare providers and stakeholders, as well as advocates, as we find ways to improve the health and well-being of all Oregonians. So I hope that you get as much out of this study as I did. Thank you.
How do you want to stage the presentation?
I believe that they have self-arranged. I believe we're going to start with the lead analyst from RAND. Is that correct? Sandy?
It's your choice.
Okay. Oh, well, okay.
Why don't we call three of them? And
there you go.
That sounds great, because I have to duck out for a minute, although I will be watching on a screen. And my staff will be here.
Panel, please.
Sure. Chapin White from Rand, Nora Leibowitz, and Zachary Goldman.
Great.
And I believe we have their presentation up on PowerPoint.
Please introduce yourself when you start.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Zachary Goldman. I'm the Economic Policy Advisor with the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you, Representative Smith-Warner, for that introduction. Pursuant to HB 3260 and House Bill 2828 of the 2015 session, the Oregon Health Authority posted a request for proposals and selected the RAND Corporation and subcontractor Health Management Associates to conduct these analyses. In the final report, which was submitted to the legislature earlier this year, the contractors modeled three different scenarios and compared each scenario to the status quo of today. Those three scenarios analyzed were a single-payer plan, secondly, healthcare ingenuity plan, which would be a state-run managed competition program, and thirdly, an alternative marketplace plan, which would function as a public option available on the marketplace. The contractors now will describe these scenarios and their assessments of each option.
Well, we have an hour scheduled for this presentation, but I think if the committee wants to ask questions on the way to clarify anything, let's ask those questions and then hold the last 15 or 20 minutes or so for other questions.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chapin White. I'm a senior policy researcher with the RAND Corporation. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, thank you for inviting us to speak with you today. We're going to be discussing the report that has already been teed up. And this presentation, initially we were thinking that we would want to fit it into 15 minutes, but it sounds like we have you're comfortable with spending more time than that.
Yeah. Well, I think that we'll generate lots of discussion, so I think if you cover the basics and where we're going, we'll have time to talk about it. That'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah,
so this slide summarizes some of the leadership role that Oregon has played in health reform, along with some of the other key states. You all know this history better than I do, certainly. To recap the four policy options that we compared in the analysis, the status quo we have on the right that presumes that the Affordable Care Act continues as is, that current trends in healthcare costs and population growth continue more or less on the current trajectory. The first alternative is the public option, and the notion there is for a state-administered health plan to be offered in the marketplace alongside the private plans that are currently offered. The other alternative is the healthcare ingenuity plan, or HCIP, and the notion there is that it would be like a managed competition system of competing private plans, like the marketplace, but expanded to cover all residents of the state of Oregon, except for Medicare beneficiaries and enrollees in the Federal Employee Plan, Indian Health Service, and the VA. The last option is the single-payer option, which would be another approach to universal coverage under the single-payer option. Patients would have low or no cost sharing. It would be adjusted based on their family income level. There would be a single state-administered plan that would enroll all residents of the state, including current Medicare beneficiaries and enrollees in the federal programs I just mentioned. Both HCIP and single-payer would be financed with new state tax sources. At the same time, employers, individuals in the state of Oregon would no longer be paying premiums for the health care they receive. All three of these options are redirecting, financing, and insuring people through different mechanisms. In terms of the methods we use, the we followed three major phases in the analysis. The first phase was to work closely with OHA and with the legislative sponsors to fill in many of the details in the proposals. The legislation that called for the study was at a very, very high level and gave the gist of the of what these proposals should consist of. There were many details that had to be filled in. Our goal in general was to be consistent with the spirit of the proposals and at the same time design the financing arrangements so that the financing would add up. The second major phase of the study was interviewing state leaders, particularly in the agencies that would be administering these programs, and also reviewing the body of literature, both relating to Oregon but other states, on single-payer proposals in particular. And then the last phase was we used RAND's simulation modeling capabilities to project the scenarios in Oregon under these four policy options. So we projected everything forward to the year 2020, and we created four parallel universes to reflect the four policy options. And then the setup allowed us to compare financing, costs, coverage under those four options, but all in the year 2020. We evaluated the four options using six domains or sets of criteria. The first is financial barriers to accessing care. So this reflects how much patients have to pay to receive care and whether that results in patients not receiving care because of financial burden. The second dimension is the total cost of the healthcare system. The third dimension is provider reimbursement. So this is how much are physicians and hospitals being paid for the services they provide. The fourth dimension is the availability of services. So this isn't just does someone have insurance coverage? Are they able to pay? But is there a provider willing and able to treat the patient? The fifth dimension is the statewide economic effects. So we looked at changes in gross state product and employment. And then the last dimension was the feasibility. And feasibility includes legal and regulatory hurdles, mainly having to do with Oregon's relationship with the federal government, and also the degree of change or upheaval in the state's role and what new roles the state will be taking on under each of the options. So I could talk through the eligibility and benefits. I'd actually like to call out just a couple key points from the slide, and then we'll move to a graphic that I think does a better job of conveying how people would be covered under these different options. One of the first things to point out is that the scope of benefits under all of these options would consist of the essential health benefits as defined under the Affordable Care Act. In terms of cost sharing, under the public option, the public option would follow the Affordable Care Act's cost-sharing schedules, where people in lower-income ranges are eligible for cost-sharing reductions. Those cost-sharing reductions would be applied in the public option as well. Under the HCIP plan, we also assumed that there would be income-based cost-sharing and that depending on the individual's household income relative to the federal poverty level, they would be auto-enrolled in a plan with a level of actuarial value that corresponded to their income. And the actuarial value that we assigned based on income followed the Affordable Care Act's cost-sharing schedule. So in other words, somebody in the income range above 250% of the federal poverty level would be eligible for a plan under HCIP that would have a 70% actuarial value. That's a silver plan. As you go down the income scale in the HCIP proposal, the actuarial value of the plan that a person was automatically eligible for and enrolled in would rise, so that people below 138% of the federal poverty level would face minimal or no cost sharing under HCIP. Under the single payer scenario, cost sharing is reduced even further. Anybody below 250% of the federal poverty level would have minimal or no cost sharing. and people above 250% of the federal poverty level would be in a plan with an actuarial value of 96% on average, meaning that 96% of total health care expenditures would be paid by the single-payer plan for people above 250% FPL. The remaining 4% would be paid by individuals. So this graphic illustrates how residents of Oregon would be covered under the four policy options. So the status quo, again, is on the far right. We have the gray bar at the bottom. That's Medicare and the other federal programs, FEHB, the VA, and Indian Health Service. The largest source of coverage in Oregon, like in most states, is employer-sponsored group coverage. Then we have Medicaid, and then there's a fairly small group enrolled in non-group plans, and then the small black bar at the top is the uninsured. And we project that in 2020, about 5% of the Oregon population would be uninsured. Going from the status quo to the public option has a relatively minor impact. The people who would be most directly impacted would be enrollees in non-group plans. They would have a new public option that they could choose to enroll in. The people in Medicaid and most people in employer-sponsored plans would not be directly impacted by adding a public option. Workers at small firms, those firms could choose to buy through a marketplace plan, and so small firm workers could be enrolled in the public option. Under HCIP, HCIP would have a more significant impact on where people get their health insurance coverage. Under HCIP, enrollees in Medicare and the federal programs would remain where they are, but all other permanent residents of the state of Oregon would be enrolled in the HCIP managed competition system. Under single payer would be the most, would entail the most change. Under single payer, the entire Oregon resident population would be enrolled in the single state administered plan, including Medicare, current Medicare beneficiaries, and enrollees in the federal plans. In terms of the financing for these different options, the financing for the public option would be the least disruptive. Under the public option, the notion is that the state would administer a plan offered in the marketplace. That plan would receive federal subsidies through tax credits and cost-sharing reduction subsidies, the same way that the current private plans in the marketplace do. And no new state financing sources would be required to set up the public option. Under HCIP and single payer, there would be some fairly major shifts in how healthcare is financed. Under HCIP, it's a little unfortunate that there's a row that we should have added to this slide, which is employer premium payments for employer-sponsored health benefits. And under HCIP, those would mostly go away. Employers would have the option of providing supplemental benefits to their workers if they chose, but most of the employers who offer healthcare benefits to their workers would be able to have their workers enrolled in HCIP instead, and they would no longer be on the hook for paying their share of premiums for employer-sponsored health benefits. That source of financing would be replaced with a new state sales tax on non-essential goods and services. Under single payer, premium payments by employers would go away entirely. Premium payments by individuals would go away entirely. There would be new state financing through a new payroll tax on firms with 20 or more workers. There would be an increase in state income tax revenues. And we also, the way we specified and modeled the single payer, we also assumed that there would be a reduction in provider payment rates in order to make the financing add up. That's something that I expect people will have questions about. Yes.
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious about why you would have a different revenue source for single payer versus HCIP.
those revenue sources were, I'm not sure how in what level of detail they were spelled out in the legislation in HB 3260, but in the at the stage of OHA issuing the RFP for the project, it was those specifications had been laid down. So the HKIP, the vision was for it to be financed through a sales tax.
Okay.
Single payer, the vision was for it to be financed through payroll and income taxes. The levels of those taxes and some of the details about which firms would be exempt, what categories of essential goods and services would be exempt, that those weren't specified, and those were some of the details we had to work through. But these financing sources were attached to these policy options, more or less from the beginning.
So, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, this wouldn't necessarily have been your suggestion. This is what was given to you as the parameters of the bill.
That's
okay, thank you.
Thank you, Grant.
So let's look at some dollar totals. So we again have the four policy options arranged in the columns. Each of the rows is representing a total amount paid for healthcare services in the year 2020. One of the first things I want to point out is that the bottom row, we have total payments for healthcare services provided to residents of Oregon in the year 2020. Under the status quo, public option, HKIP, and single payer, those total payments for healthcare services are, I don't want to say the same. There's a difference of some billions of dollars across them, but they're roughly on par. Where these policy options differ dramatically is in where those payments are coming from. So if we look at the top row, these are premium payments by households and by employers, plus out-of-pocket payments by patients when they're receiving healthcare services. Under the status quo, we project that those total payments would be around $14 billion in 2020. Moving to the public option reduces those slightly because the public option would be a less expensive health plan offered on the marketplace. Moving to HKIP would reduce premiums pretty substantially and would reduce out-of-pocket somewhat. The reduction in premiums under HKIP is due to the fact that people who currently are enrolled in employer-sponsored health benefits would be moved into HKIP. HKIP would pay for the base plan for those enrollees. Employers would no longer have to pay their share of premiums for their workers. That's the major reason for premiums plus out-of-pocket dropping under HKIP. Under single payer, households and employers would no longer pay any premiums for health care coverage. Out-of-pocket payments would be reduced substantially because people below 250% FPL would pay no cost sharing at the point of service. People above would pay only modest cost sharing. So total payments by residents of Oregon under single payer would only be $0.7 billion, payments in the form of premiums plus out-of-pocket. Federal outlays is the next row, and federal outlays are more or less constant across the four options, and that's by design. One of the starting points for the analysis was the presumption that the federal government, assessing whether these policy options were allowable, would require a budget neutrality test. So when we were designing the financing for HKIP, when we were specifying the tax rates, we started with the presumption that the federal government financing would be more or less the same as under the status quo. The federal outlays under the public option dropped somewhat because the public option would be somewhat less expensive than the plans currently offered in the marketplace. That would reduce federal subsidies for non-group coverage. That's the reason federal outlays drop in the public option. Under HKIP and single payer, they're designed to be more or less the same as under the status quo.
And the overall cost, your projections are the overall cost of all four would be approximately the same?
That's right.
Although a couple billion less.
Yeah, so the total payments for healthcare under the public option would be somewhat less because the enrollees in the public plan would be in a somewhat less expensive plan. Under HCIP, total payments for healthcare services in Oregon would be somewhat higher than under the status quo. And what's going on there is HCIP would take enrollees in Medicaid and the uninsured, along with enrollees in employer-sponsored plans and non-group plans, move them all into HCIP, where they would all be enrolled in private plans. Typically, private plans pay providers higher rates than Medicaid plans do because of providers receiving higher payment rates. In the HCIP scenario, total payments would be somewhat higher than under the status quo. Under the single-payer, total payments for healthcare would be more or less the same as under the status quo.
Assurances there it's
going to be. Tenemer?
I guess I'm wondering about this $23 billion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about this $23 billion of federal outlay. What's that predicated on, and how stable do you think that is?
That's a good question. So
that's about the second part when we rule out of order.
Okay. The $23 billion includes federal outlays for Medicare, Medicaid, plus federal employees plan, VA, Indian Health Service.
I think I understand its sources. I just don't know how reliable it is.
Yes.
Who knows?
Yeah. That's a great question. So the American Health Care Act, AHCA, which didn't progress out of the House or even to a vote, would have substantially impacted these federal outlays. I don't know if this is the right time to get into ACA repeal and replace and its potential implications.
No, I think it's not. Let's go through your story.
I have a question.
Good.
Thank you, Chair. Can you go over the state outlay and where those dollars are coming from specifically?
Yes. So state outlays under the status quo and the public option, those are the state's payments for Medicaid and CHIP. Under HCIP, the state outlays rise substantially because the state under HCIP would be taking the federal funding, adding to it the new state sales tax revenues, and then paying for a basic health plan. Well, I shouldn't use the term basic health plan. Paying for a health plan offered through the HCIP managed competition setup. Under single payer, the state outlays would be $15 billion, and there the state would be taking federal funding for Oregon's universal coverage, adding to it state funding from the new payroll tax plus an increase in income tax revenues, and then that federal plus new state funding plus the $1.8 billion that the state would have spent on Medicaid and CHIP would be used to finance care under the single payer system.
Can you explain HCIP a little more? So we have that background clear in the committee.
Can I have a follow-up really quick?
Okay.
Just to that. So the state outlays, the $15 billion under single payer, the 10.3, the 1.8, actually the 10.3 and the 14.9, those are derived from new tax dollars.
Right.
In the state. So it isn't federal money. That would have to come from new taxes generated in the state.
Yes, but it's also important to note that employers would no longer be paying their employer premium payments, both under HCIP and single payer, and individuals would no longer be paying premiums under single payer.
Can I have one more?
Yeah.
Sure. Do we know the difference between what an employer pays on average for the health care versus what they would pay out in the payroll tax? The sales tax I know would be difficult because you really can't. That's a tough one. But on the single payer side, do we know what that – do you have any idea what that might be, what the difference is if it
– Yes. The payroll tax rate under the single payer option was – modeled at 6.5% applied to firms with 20 or more workers. And the amount of revenue raised from that payroll tax is roughly the same in the aggregate as total premium payments by employers for employer-sponsored health benefits. So now that firm by firm, there's going to be differences between what the firms would be paying under the status quo for employer-sponsored health benefits and what their payroll tax obligation would be. But in the aggregate, the payroll tax revenues were designed to roughly match what employers are currently paying for health benefits for their workers.
Thank you.
Would you explain the issue? I think not everybody was around here in 92 to remember what was going on. Would you just give us a little more background on that for the committee?
And could you say more how HCIP would work? Or
How it would work.
Yeah. So let's see. I think the best working example is if you go on healthcare.gov, there's a menu of plans to choose from. You enter your income, and you're given a set of options where the deductibles and the coinsurance and copays are all adjusted to take into account cost sharing reductions. That is similar to what we envision for HCIP. In HCIP, the state would be in the role of the sponsor of a managed competition system, where the state would be setting the rules for what health benefits needed to be offered and any other requirements for health plans to be able to participate. But then plans would be offering a standardized set of benefits with standardized cost sharing that's adjusted based on the enrollee's income, and then enrollees could choose from among a set of private health plans.
It would be the way we envision the marketplace writ large rather than necessarily the way it came out.
Exactly.
Mr. Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. And in looking at your plan here, I had a question on I assume this is specific for Oregon. You said that the increase of population would be 12% to receive health care. Yet don't we have about 90%, 95% of adults and 98% of children covered? My question is the delta between that roughly 4 and 12% undocumented workers that are calculated into that?
That's part of it. Let me actually go back a couple slides. So under the status quo, about 5% of the population would be uninsured. Many of them are some of them are undocumented. Some of them are in other groups. The increase in the demand for healthcare services going from the status quo to single payer would partly be coming from newly insuring that 5% of the Oregon population, but the other important factor under single payer is that the level of cost sharing, deductibles, copays, coinsurance would fall substantially, pretty much for all residents of Oregon. For people in the lower income ranges, that reduction in cost sharing would be the most dramatic. It would go to essentially no cost sharing. But for people above 250% federal poverty line, going from current coverage to a plan with a 96% actuarial value would generally reduce out-of-pocket, and all of that would tend to increase patient demand for care and increase the number of patients seeking out services.
So it's a 12% increase, not in population, but services.
Right.
Okay, all right, that makes a different follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So then on kind of the analysis, you come up with a 22% reduction for single payer in the state of Oregon. And it appears to be built into there, assuming that there is not a national single payer, meaning you're taking advantage of some Medicare, Medicaid payments to where the cost shift to the federal government would actually be 11% of that 22% or half of the 22% gain for the state of Oregon, unless there was a national shift to single payer. Then can I derive from that analysis that a single payer would effectively save Oregon 11% across the board? Is that a fair assumption?
But the 22%, could you say again?
Page 101 of your of your report says that there would be a single payer would be a 22% reduction, but I'm reading into that a cost shift of 11% from the government just from letting retired public employees get into Medicare and that, you know, that concept.
Okay.
Where if there was a national single payer based on 18 other published reports, blah, 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 that the cost savings would only be 11%. So I'm trying to derive from that, is the cost savings really cost shifting 50% of the savings, and the state would, in effect, if the, making the assumption the federal government would cover the whole population, which I think is in question, and had a single payer, the savings that you're proposing would be 11%.
The 22% that you're referring to is just in reference to the administrative expenses, which is a portion of total payments for healthcare, but is a fairly small proportion. So the so the single payer, moving from the status quo to the single payer option, would result in a fairly substantial reduction in administrative expenses, but total payments for healthcare, including payments to providers plus administrative expenses, would be roughly the same as under the current system.
So there wouldn't be in the total once you add that back in. You're having economies of scale by having it under one administrative.
That's right.
Okay.
But you're covering more people.
You're covering more people.
Right.
That's why it comes up to the same.
Go ahead. Great. Okay. Thank you.
So in terms of provider payments and how services would be delivered across all three of the options, as well as the status quo, services would be delivered predominantly by private providers and integrated delivery systems. We didn't contemplate a single payer arrangement where hospital employees or physicians would be employees of the state. Rather, they'd be paid for their services through these different financing mechanisms.
Can I ask a question?
Kenny, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say 10% below status quo, do you mean status quo commercial rates or Medicaid rates?
Well, the status quo that we're referring to in the provider payments is the average, including commercial plus Medicare plus Medicaid. So in general, commercial plans pay higher rates than Medicare and Medicaid. The average is somewhere in between. The assumption in modeling the single-payer plan was that the payment rate set by the state-administered plan would be 10% below that average. So likely above Medicare and Medicaid.
And but below commercial.
Below commercial. Under HCIP, private plans would be negotiating their payment rates with providers, similar to the way private plans currently operate. Now, under the public option, this is a fairly important specification. We assumed that the public option being offered in the marketplace would be paying providers using the Medicare fee-for-service rate schedule. And we also assumed that providers would be, the state, in order to encourage providers to participate in this public option, would say to providers, if you want to participate in any of the health plans being offered to state employees, you also have to participate in the public option. The notion there is not to be draconian by any means, but rather to give the public option an advantage in terms of being competitive against the private health plans that are currently being offered in the marketplace. And the notion is that if the state-administered public option can pay providers following the Medicare fee schedule, it can have lower administrative expenses by piggybacking onto Medicare's rate setting. It wouldn't have to negotiate payment rates with providers. It would also be paying rates that tend to be lower than commercial plans. All of that would allow it to offer a premium that would be lower than the other plans being currently offered. And it would also allow the state to offer a plan with a broad set of participating providers. All of that leads to the public option being competitive and drawing enrollment. And if you take away those features of the public option, if you make the public option the same as the plans that are currently being offered, then there's no reason to expect much action. So that's a key specification for the public option. Under the administration of the plans, the state would be receiving financing, and under HCIP would be distributing that funding to private health plans. Under the single payer plan, the state would be pooling financing and then overseeing private contractors who are administering claims and paying providers for the services they provide. Okay. Nora, would you like to step in?
Sure. For the record, my name is Nora Leibowitz. I work for Health Management Associates. And I'm going to talk briefly about some of the implementation considerations and administrative considerations for the different options. As should be evident from the discussion that Chapin has had so far, the public option as a more limited change from the status quo would involve less implementation effort. Primarily, it would be legislative change at the state level and working out with any contractors for the actual administration of the plan. Both HCIP and single payer have more substantial implementation considerations. And in both situations, a lot of the lift there is related to federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and other federal approvals. Both would need to get approvals for making changes to the Medicaid waiver, getting a what's called a 1332 waiver or Wyden waiver from the Affordable Care Act for the commercial side, being able to use the funds that are currently going to fund the cost sharing and tax credits for premiums, and then as well in single payer, getting a Medicare waiver. In addition to all of the in-house, in-state, third-party contracting. So both of those involve quite heavy lift in terms of setting up these programs. As Chapin mentioned, the public option adds a population to what's currently going on in the state. The state already administers benefits for public employees and for education employees through PEB and OWEB, as well as the Medicaid program. So adding an additional piece of work for a public option would be less of a major change compared to HCIP and single payer, where a new centralized administration function would be set up. We didn't identify what the structure would look like administratively, whether it would be OHA or DCBS, just that an entity would need to do a key set of work. Similarly, you can see an ongoing thread through this that from the public option that there are mostly because of the rates paid to providers, some savings to the state, assuming that the state costs to administer this are relatively static, that it's not for some reason very expensive to administer. For single payer and HCIP, there are savings associated with the administrative side. You see an overall savings on the single payer of about $100 million for the state, and a much larger $1 billion a year on the federal total, most of which is the federal side, because as you are more efficient in Medicaid and Medicare-funded individuals, much of that money for Medicaid and all of the money for Medicare is going to accrue, the benefits are going to accrue to the federal government. And then there are some similar savings from consolidating purchasing under HCIP, but there are also overall costs related to paying for services at commercial rates that balances out the savings. For the impacts, obviously single payer and HCIP, as they were built, that one, the main impact is that they provide universal coverage for all Oregonians, whereas public option is a much smaller expansion in coverage, and the overall impacts are commensurate with that much smaller change. It doesn't have.
What do you estimate would be in the public option? How many people?
How many people? That's a good question. We actually in the non-group market in Oregon, we projected would account for about 6% of the population, and we assumed that the premiums paid for non-group plans would match the premiums of the public option. We didn't specify. We avoided having to specify what share of the non-group market would actually be in the public option. My starting point for thinking about what share would be in the public option is the Medicare program, where we have the traditional fee-for-service program and Medicare Advantage plans, and nationwide, it's about two-thirds of beneficiaries are in the traditional fee-for-service program. About one-third are in a private Medicare Advantage plan. I wouldn't say that's exactly
Oregon,
how it's going
think,
to play out.
It? Right.
It's higher in Oregon.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. But my expectation is that in the non-group market, if there were a public option with the specifications that we mentioned, paying Medicare rates and having relatively low administrative expenses, it would probably enroll the majority of the non-group market, and would also attract a fair number of small employers who are permitted to buy through the buy marketplace plans. We assume that those small employers would also be able to buy the public option.
You might get 10% of the population, 15. Relatively small impact.
Yeah.
Sorry, Nora, go ahead.
So the other key impact on the single payer side is really one that we've identified as a sea change in how people get access to care, which is that right now much of people's access to coverage and care is tied to their ability to pay for it, and so to the extent that you do or don't have funds to pay for care, you're going to be able to get care or not, and that would essentially go away under a single payer program, and that the access to care would be based on the availability of providers to provide those services. That on its own, single payer doesn't have an impact on how many providers are in Union County, for example, but that everyone in Union County has essentially the same access. And then just on the HCIP, noting that system costs are projected to rise under HCIP, primarily because if you're putting more people into a system that pays providers at a higher rate, it increases system costs. And then finally, in terms of the impacts and feasibility analysis, I talked about this a little bit before, but the public option doesn't require a lot of federal hurdles. The ACA has a pathway for this to happen. No waivers are required. But for both single payer and HCIP, there are some significant hurdles to getting federal approvals. On the single payer side, ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, would be a significant challenge. And in fact, literally, there would likely be a challenge to such a plan based on states' ability to make rules that impact employers in terms of what benefits they provide and how they provide them. In addition to a potential ERISA problem, the state would have to get federal approval for using Medicare funds, using Medicaid funds, using the what's currently provided through the premium tax credits, all of which are a significant piece of work. And particularly for Medicare, there's not a good model for other states. Only one state has a waiver to basically control how Medicare dollars are used, which is Maryland, and even Vermont, which kind of was negotiating with the federal government about doing this, ended up backing up to more of a coordination program than a controlling Medicare finances.
So, can I ask a question on the ERISA situation? Doesn't the state have the right to apply a tax to an employer?
Chair Greenlick, yes, the state does retain the right to impose taxes on employers. Where the challenge comes in is if the state, by imposing something like a payroll tax that is significant, is essentially saying, employer, you would be silly to provide benefits and pay a payroll tax, that they are,
that would be the
argument would
choice.
Be they would be forcing the employer to give benefits to their employees through this state program.
If it was funded by a sales tax?
A payroll tax.
No, if it was funded by a sales tax? Well, there is a proposal on the books to fund it by a sales tax.
Well, if it doesn't...
Would that be an ERISA challenge?
I want to state for the record, I'm not a lawyer. I think that would be a different issue than something that's particularly targeting employers. I just know that because of some of the vagueness of how ERISA is written, a lot of the things that have worked and not worked under ERISA have been figured out through court challenges. So many of those have been about payroll taxes that either target specific employers with more than X number of employees who pay minimum wage or, you know, whatever that's targeting.
We have had a proposal by John DiLorenzo, a business lobbyist, to create a single-payer model funded entirely by a sales tax. I assume he did that because he assumed it would not mount an ERISA challenge.
Right, and that is that's essentially the concept behind the HCIP, is that idea of avoiding the potential ERISA challenge. And similarly, it avoids a need for a Medicare waiver because it just doesn't include that population. Mm-hmm. So.
The bottom line?
Bottom line. Okay. So each of the three policy options here we're summarizing how they would differ from the status quo. So in terms of enrollment in health insurance coverage, the public option would result in an increase in health insurance enrollment, but fairly small. HCIP and single payer by design would enroll all residents of Oregon. In terms of
You're not getting all the special.
Oh, no. Mm. Oh, that's too bad. We have a...
So she
do you have any suggestions?
Yes, she has the PowerPoint version.
Oh, the PowerPoint version. Okay.
Just in case that's
great. I'll say, while this is... Thank you. While this is... okay. financial barriers, going from the status quo to the public option would reduce financial barriers somewhat. That's partly by covering some additional residents of Oregon, but mainly the reduction in financial barriers under the public option comes from participants in the public option paying slightly lower premiums. Under HCIP, financial barriers to accessing care would be reduced fairly substantially, especially for low-income residents, partly because all low-income residents would be auto-enrolled in a health plan. HCIP also has cost sharing that is adjusted based on your household income. Single payer would result in the largest reduction in financial barriers for the low-income population. Financial barriers to accessing care would be more or less eliminated, and for the middle and upper-income residents of Oregon, they would also generally see reductions in financial barriers to accessing care.
And that would depend on how the tax structure is designed, I think, as well.
Yes, that's a good point. The financial barriers is really just getting at the out-of-pocket payments at the point of receiving services. The overall burden of paying for healthcare would include that, those out-of-pocket, which are a relatively small share of the total, plus tax burden plus premium payments. And let me go through the rest of these rows, and maybe we could come back to the question of the burden of financing care under single payer. In terms of the total system cost, the total cost of the healthcare system would decrease somewhat under the public option because of paying providers lower rates in the state administered plan. Under HCIP, system costs would increase. That's mainly from moving Medicaid enrollees and the uninsured into private plans paying private rates. Under single payer, as we specified it, there would be little change in total system costs. In terms of provider reimbursement, here we're getting at a physician or a hospital when they're providing a given service, how much revenue do they get for providing that service. Under the public option, provider reimbursements would fall somewhat, and that's because some residents of Oregon would be in this state-administered public option paying Medicare rates, which are below the current average. Moving to HCIP would increase average provider reimbursement rates, and then moving to single payer, this was a specification. This isn't inherent to the notion of a single payer plan, but we assumed that the state would set its payment rates about 10% below the average, and so provider reimbursements would decrease on average. In terms of the availability of services, so this is not getting at the issue of financial barriers to accessing care at the point of service, but rather the availability and willingness of providers to provide services. Under the public option, we see relatively little change. Under HCIP, service availability would improve, and that reflects, again, moving Medicaid beneficiaries into private plans paying private rates. Our interpretation is that that would lead to some improvement in the ability to access care. Under the single payer, the availability of services we projected would worsen somewhat, and this is reflecting the fact that single payer is covering the 5% of the Oregon resident population that would be uninsured. For people who are who would have health insurance otherwise, a single payer would reduce their out-of-pocket expenditures. All of that's going to lead more patients to be seeking care. At the same time, the way we specified the single-payer plan, and this was to make the financing work out a little better, provider reimbursements would be reduced so that physicians, hospitals, most other providers would receive somewhat lower reimbursements on average than they get under the current system. So the combination of more patients seeking out services and a reduction in provider reimbursement rates would lead to some worsening of service availability. How that would play out over the long run is a little speculative, but you could imagine providers adjusting the way they deliver care to accommodate the influx of patients. And as Nora pointed out, every healthcare system is allocating a limited set of clinical resources under the single-payer arrangement. That allocation of services would be limited mainly by the availability of providers rather than by patients' willingness and ability to pay. In terms of the impacts on the state economy, really these impacts are all fairly minor. There's some movement in employment and gross state product, but these options are set up to draw down the same amount of federal funding as the status quo. And if you're leaving the federal inflow of funding into the state fixed, then it's unlikely that you're going to see major changes in employment or GSP. That's different than a Medicaid expansion or a dramatic cut in federal funding for Medicaid. That could have significant state impacts on the state economy because that's adding or subtracting major amounts of federal money from the state economy. And in terms of feasibility, adding the public option is within the scope of the activities the state currently undertakes. It wouldn't require any federal waivers and likely wouldn't arouse any ERISA challenges. HCIP would be more challenging. That it would be more disruptive to the flows of financing and the sources of health insurance coverage. It would be a fairly major change in the role the state plays in the healthcare system. And then single payer would involve the most upheaval or change in terms of where people get their coverage, how care is financed, and the role of the state. The single payer plan is very likely to encounter a challenge under ERISA. Getting around that challenge could require federal legislation, which is obviously a heavy lift, or some fancy lawyer. Neither of us is a lawyer. So that's the bottom line, and we'd be interested to hear questions. Or
I think we have a couple minutes for questions. Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. A couple questions and then just a comment. How did you define essential health benefits when you did the analysis?
Essential health benefits, we defined following the definitions in the Affordable Care Act where they laid out the 10 categories of services, including inpatient services, prescription drugs, outpatient physician, maternity care, but it's a comprehensive benefit package. It does not include dental care for adults or vision. Those are fairly expensive add-ons that are not included in the essential health benefits. It also doesn't include long-term care, either facility-based or long-term care at home.
One more question, comment. Did you include public employees in this analysis?
Yes. In HCIP and the single-payer option, public employees would be folded into that universal coverage plan.
Yeah. In my comment, Chair, if I may, my contention for a long time, and even more so after seeing this, is where we should concentrate our efforts is the delivery system and how providers are paid. I think the finance, it's not where the real value is for us in terms of making progress towards our goals.
Thank you. I have a question about pharmaceutical costs and whether you try to look at whether any of these different systems could impact that. You know, certainly I wonder with a single-payer system whether you have a stronger negotiating power in that. So I just wondered if you had any examination of that.
Yeah, under single-payer, we assumed that the state would be setting payment rates for physician and hospital services and most other types of providers. On the prescription drugs, we didn't make any specific assumptions about how the state would be, what type of pharmacy benefit managers they would engage with, or how and whether they would use the state's enhanced buying power to try to push down prescription drug prices. That my sense is there's room for the state to explore options for bringing down prescription drug prices, and it's also worth pointing out that when we talk about reducing reimbursement rates for physicians and hospitals and therapists, that those are all providers who are within the state of Oregon. When we're talking about pharmaceutical prices, obviously there are pharmacies and distributors in the state of Oregon, but a lot of the revenues from those pharmaceutical firms go outside the state of Oregon. That it would make sense to me to explore ways the state could bring down prescription drug prices, but that was something we didn't explore just.
And Representative Kinnegar and Representative Bueller, I think you both raise from different questions you've raised a key issue that is not necessarily part of this analysis because we were asked to look at financing, but I think is raised by the analysis, which is that to the extent that a structure provides greater leverage through single payer or HCIP having many more lives included, that you have that leverage to make change. And Representative Bueller's comment about delivery system being the big thing, the connection between this work, whether on a specific area like pharmacy or using the CCO model or whatever, that having the ability to control how the funds are used gives you a lot more
leverage.
And therefore makes it a lot more dangerous to hard to get in. Well, I really do appreciate you coming and sharing this with us today. The whole report's available for people to study. And you guys did a great job in very limited time. And I thank you for your presentation.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate it.
Would you get the lights on? We'll close the informational hearing and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 60. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 60 requires that the chair of the Oregon Medical Board to select at least one but no more than three former board members to serve as an emeritus members on the 13-member medical board. The effective date is January 1, 2018. This has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This left the Senate floor with 29 ayes and 2 excused votes, Mr. Chair.
No, it didn't. No,
I don't
one
think excused so. Vote. 28.
There's an extra senator.
They only have 3.
I wondered how they were doing that.
28 ayes
oh,
and
he
2
said
excused.
29.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm going, I can add 8 and 2. Sorry, 28 ayes, 2 excused.
Would you call the 2 witnesses, please?
Sure. Nicole Krishnaswamy from the Oregon Medical Board and Courtney Dresser from the Oregon Medical Association.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Krishnaswamy, and I am the Legislative and Policy Analyst for the Oregon Medical Board. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 60 today, which will allow a board member who has recently ended his or her term on the board to come back and fill in during an absence of a sitting member. Our public and professional members who perform the important work of ensuring patient safety are very busy people, and they sometimes have absences. And when that happens, that slows down the board's work. Senate Bill 60 would allow board members to serve as emeritus members for up to 3 years after ending their term. The board's chair would appoint those emeritus members. They would have been recently confirmed by the Senate and familiar with the board's operations. The governor would approve those selections, and the emeritus members would serve at her pleasure. Their names, biographies, and dates of service would all be included on our website to ensure transparency. In the event of a sitting board member's absence, the emeritus member that is selected to substitute would have the same license or public position as the absent member, and that would ensure full representation on the board for decision making. We believe that this bill will improve the board's efficiency and effectiveness. As you heard, Senate Bill 60 unanimously passed out of the Senate committee. Senator Steiner Hayward carried it on the floor, and it received a unanimous vote there as well. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. Just here to say that we do support this concept in this bill, and we hope that you will support it.
Are there any questions in the panel? Thank you very much. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 60, and open three public hearings since we only have one witness on all three, and it's the same witness. We'll do it in some semblance of order. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 69, Senate Bill 70, and Senate Bill 71. Madam Administrator, would you review those quickly, and then let the jury speak for itself?
Sure. Senate Bill 69 clarifies the duties of the Oregon State Board of Nursing relating to applicants for licensure and standards for delegation of patient care tasks. There's no fiscal or revenue. This too left the Senate floor 28 ayes and 2 excused. Senate Bill 70 clarifies and updates the licensure application and issuance process for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. That effective date is January 1, 2018. Again, no fiscal, no revenue. Floor vote, 29 ayes, 1 excused. And 71, measure clarifies existing Oregon law that allows for nursing assistants to administer medications in long-term care facilities when supervised by a registered nurse, an effective date of January 1, 2018. No fiscal, no revenue. Again, 29 ayes, 1 excused off the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ruby Jason, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. All three of these bills are language clarifications. Some of these statutes were written in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and have not been updated since. So this is just language clarification. Senate Bill 69, the Oregon State Board of Nursing wishes to submit testimony in support of Senate Bill 69. The purpose of this bill is to bring current outdated law into alignment with modern nursing license exam methods and broaden the type of practitioners that may be consulted by the board to better reflect current nursing situations and practice. The existing language in several sections of ORS 678.150 was written before there was a national nursing license exam and before the advent of nursing assistants. Specifically, 678.1506F refers to Oregon administering license examinations at the request of other states. This practice was discontinued when the computerized national exam was adopted several decades ago. In addition, 678.1506I contains outdated limits regarding the types of healthcare practitioners who must be consulted by the board during rulemaking regarding the administration of non-injectable medications by nursing assistants. Current language specifies only three types of practitioners: physicians, gerontologists, and pharmacologists. Broader language would give the board more flexibility in involving additional stakeholders and better represent modern healthcare practice. We anticipate there is no financial impact as a result of this bill, and we have received support from various stakeholders, and there is no known opposition, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Did you talk about 70 as well?
70? Okay.
And 70 and 71?
Yeah.
All set?
I'm good.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and Vice Chair Hayden, and members of the committee, the Oregon State Board of Nursing wishes to submit testimony in support of Senate Bill 70. The purpose of the bill is threefold. It will bring outdated law into alignment with modern licensing processes by deleting references to the U.S. mail. It will reflect current statutory requirements regarding the expedited licensing of military spouses, and it will delete obsolete statutory language regarding nursing licensure exams. Currently, language in the three sections of ORS 678.050 contain extremely outdated licensing requirements. In 678, 0.0501, it states that licensure exam dates will be sent out via U.S. mail to all nursing programs. The National Council Licensing Examination, or the NCLEX, that is used by all 50 states, switched to electronic testing a couple of decades ago, which allows applicants to sign up through a website. Depending on the time of year, the NCLEX is offered almost daily. The board does not set the testing schedule. The computerized process for testing negates setting specific testing dates. ORS 678.0503C speaks to the board issuing nursing licenses immediately if the applicant appears in person. This language predates current public safety requirements for criminal background checks to be performed prior to licensure. There is no circumstance under which the board would issue a license immediately. Lastly, ORS 678.0504A refers to the issuance of a limited license to graduates of nursing education programs once the graduate has applied to take the licensure exam. This language predates computerized testing, which has dramatically shortened the licensing process. What used to take months for a graduate to schedule, take, and pass a nursing licensure exam now takes a few weeks, if not days. Limited licenses for nursing graduates are no longer issued or needed. Senate Bill 70 would bring outdated law into alignment with modern licensing practices by deleting references to U.S. mail in ORS 678.0501, reflecting the current statutory requirement regarding the expedited license of military spouses in ORS 678.0503C, and deleting the obsolete language in 678.0504A entirely. No fiscal impact, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
He's glad I asked you. Well, I'm
going to,
yeah. Representative
Bueller. Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. I applaud you for going back and doing this. This is no fun, but it's desperately needed. I mean, we have so many outstanding statutes that can cause problems at unusual times that you don't expect. I'd encourage you also to go back through administrative rules. If you want to see even bigger mess, start going through our administrative rules, which are horribly outdated.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, and Representative Bueller, yes, we know. And my aim at the board is to actually write this stuff in English.
Great.
So that our licensees and the public know exactly what's in the Practice Act and not keep that arcane language that nobody really understands in rule. On working on this, we also have noticed that we actually missed a few things, so probably next session I'll be back asking to update even more language, because we missed some things.
We still have these in our control, and you can amend them when you find some.
Okay. Yeah.
Would you talk about the next one?
Yes. Senate Bill 71. The Oregon State Board of Nursing wishes to submit testimony in support of Senate Bill 71. The purpose of the bill is to clarify the current statutory language by removing passive and negative phrasing in ORS 678.4451 regarding the administration of non-injectable medications by nursing assistants that currently leads to confusion. The language in ORS 678.445 is confusing and outdated in relation to current nursing practices. Specifically, the language in Section 1 is convoluted and negative. It states what the board won't do to prohibit an act, as opposed to simply stating what the board will do. And this has led to confusion amongst certified medication aides, educators, and employers. And there is no fiscal impact, and I'd be happy to ask any questions. That sentence has like three double negatives in it, and I couldn't understand it.
You need a scorecard. Any other questions? Thank you. Well, we will be keeping these for a little while. If you do have an amendment you want, let us know.
Thank you.
Still time.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 69, Senate Bill 70, and Senate Bill 71. And we are adjourned until next Monday.
We'll
adjourned until next Monday.